It is 8:30. We have with us once again live in our studios, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. So they let you back in the country.
They did. I just spent a few days up in Vancouver, B.C.
Uh-huh.
And I was just telling Jav that this happens. It never fails. This happens to me every time I go to Canada. The Canadian border guard grills me up one side and down the other. You know, do you always travel alone? How come you're only taking that little suitcase? What do you plan to do when you're in Vancouver? How many days are you seeing? You know, over and over and over again, they grill me like crazy. And then when I come back across the border, the American border guard takes one look at me and then waves me through. Doesn't ask a question, nothing.
That's because of all the weapons you have in your apartment.
They already
they figure you must be a real American.
They already know everything they need to know about you, Maria. So did you notice any big differences between Vancouver, the city, and Seattle, the city?
I did. You know, it was amazing. Vancouver is still a little bit gritty the way a city should be. In other words, it has neighborhoods where lower middle class and poor people live, you know, in particular lower middle class families.
We do too. They're called Kent, White Center, Federal Way.
No, they're called homeless in Kent.
Well, that too.
No, Seattle, because of its rising housing prices and because about 15 years back, the mayor and the city council decided that they were going to start giving gifts to developers and in order to push small hole-in-the-wall restaurants and inexpensive stores out of the city, therefore pushing poor people out of the city, Seattle no longer has those neighborhoods. So Vancouver had some wonderful attractions, slightly gritty, but still great neighborhoods with small hole-in-the-wall ethnic restaurants, designer, you know, local handmade designer clothes that you could afford. Artsy little shops where you could buy things that you can't get in Seattle because, of course, we don't have those kinds of stores anymore.
Well, don't overgeneralize. We do have some of that, but it's hard to miss it in Vancouver, whereas you know we have to know where to look here.
Yeah, you really have to know where to go. They're tiny little enclaves and they're little spots here and there that survive who knows how. I think it's because rent is so high for businesses in the city of Seattle that those little places have been pushed further and further out here. What's interesting is that Vancouver has a lot of chain stores just like Seattle. I mean, I saw way too many Starbucks in Vancouver, but I also saw a lot of little independent coffee houses still there. And I just found that kind of fascinating. Although in Vancouver, there is this move because the Vancouver the big businesses in Vancouver and a lot of the rich people and would like to do the same thing there that we've done here in Seattle. But there's been a much more pushback by the working class folks and by little independent activist groups that. You know, they haven't totally given over their city yet to developers, even though housing prices are going up and there is some loss of that kind of character to the neighborhoods.
Yeah, and as far as I know, they're not building a tunnel either.
No. No, they have a SkyTrain, monorail system that we could have had, but don't.
By the way, isn't the phrase too many Starbucks kind of redundant?
Yeah.
Just wondering.
Anyway.
All right. Moving on to a little closer to home, there appears to be a new write-in campaign for Seattle City Mayor.
Well, there's a campaign for a campaign, put it that way. And you know there's this strange bedfellows when local unions and the Seattle Times are backing each other up on this. The situation is this. We now have Joe Malahan and Mike McGinn as the two finalists for mayor. And regardless of the other relative strengths or weaknesses of the two candidates, neither one of them has ever held elected office before. Neither one of them is a local Democratic Party insider. And we know who basically runs the city of Seattle and King County. It's Democratic Party insiders. And so you have the old boys and old gals club is exceedingly nervous about both Malahan and McGinn and the prospect of either one becoming mayor. And now, mind you, this has almost nothing to do with actual policy and ideology. Yeah, McGinn is opposed to the tunnel, but he's also in favor of most of the other developer-oriented projects that Greg Nichols has backed, and in fact,
including the Mercer Beautification Project,
including the Mercer Beautification Project, and you'd really be hard pressed to find much difference between Nichols and McGinn on a lot of those issues. Malahan, he's a business executive. He's going to be sympathetic to most downtown business concerns probably, but that's the catch. Probably nobody actually knows. And because Malahan is self-funded with his own money and McGinn has his own electoral base in the environmental movement, a grassroots campaign that got him into the final, neither one of them owes their political existence to the insider club. And that is making people very, very nervous. So what you had was a poll that came out this week, commissioned by one of the local unions. The poll was leaked, so we don't really know which one yet, but probably one of the ones that was backing Greg Nichols in the primary election, showing that State Senator Ed Murray would come in a close second behind Joe Malahan and just ahead of Mike McGinn as a write-in candidate were the election to be held today. Now, there are any number of problems with that. Murray being given as an option in a poll is a little bit different from people having to take the proactive step to actually write his name in a ballot. And anybody who follows politics knows that write-in campaigns are extremely unlikely to succeed. You know, you can really count on in local political history, modern history, on one hand with any number of fingers left over the number of times in which they've been successful. But Murray would have the backing of the political establishment behind him in any such race. And that was what made it so particularly curious, is even though this was a union poll, here you had a couple of days later, Joni Balter, the very establishment voice of the reflexively anti-union Seattle Times editorial page, coming out and urging Ed Murray to run on the basis of this poll. You know, anytime you have them hand in hand, you know there's some strange bedfellows going on. Murray himself has reportedly weighing it. He has not ruled it out. There really is no downside to him running, because if he doesn't win a write-in campaign, nobody's going to blame him for that. He has for a long time had his eye on the congressional seat, waiting for Jim McDermott to retire, but, you know, get in line. A lot of people have their eye on that seat. And so it's going to be very interesting to see whether any kind of campaign like this is mounted, and if so, what the other prominent write-in campaign for Seattle Mayor Satan will do about this.
I thought for a minute there you're going to say get in line. A lot of people are waiting for Jim McDermott to retire.
Well, that's true too, but that wasn't where I was going on that particular riff.
Anyway. But yeah, no, it's fairly clear that because Ed Murray has been part of the political establishment and he has a history of having moneyed donors contribute to his campaigns, and Malahan doesn't have that, and neither does McGinn, that it's not just the Democratic Party insiders, but the major donors to the Democratic Party, including a lot of developers in the city, who are very nervous about having a candidate in who they don't hold the reins to.
Yeah.
And they can't control and put pressure on.
Yeah, there was an interesting story that was broken in Seattle Weekly a few years ago that Murray, during his day job, because of course state legislators don't get much pay, which is a whole other issue, was doing consulting work for the port the same time that he was overseeing the Port of Seattle in his legislative role. And so, you know, he obviously is willing to play ball in a way that it's not clear that either Malahan or McGinn would. And that should recommend Malahan and McGinn to many people, but not certainly to the people who run this city.
Yeah, it's almost as if this move is exposing the seamy underside of how politics in this country work. You know, you're not really considered a real politician unless you've been groomed and taught how to say one thing and do another, and do it without damaging your conscience. You know?
Yeah,
and it's not clear to political insiders and major donors that Malahan and McGinn can do that, but certainly Murray's been groomed long enough that he can do that without a problem.
Yeah, and, you know, yes, it is unfortunate and irritating that we hold these actual elections, but usually the people can be expected to fall in line, and this is one of those times
when we didn't.
Irritatingly enough, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Well, Maria, you mentioned the Mercer Beautification Project, and I just saw a quick mention, an email out of the Seattle Displacement Coalition yesterday that the price for that has gone up.
Yeah,
by another $100 million.
Yeah, yeah. Almost doubling. The cost. I think the original estimates, which was interesting, John Fox had pointed this out in his email, that the original estimate of the phase one of the Mercer Beautification Project was somewhere around 40 to 60 million, and now it's up to around 190 million.
290. It went from 190
well,
to
no,
290.
Well, no, 190 for phase one.
Oh, right.
The extra 100 million will be for phase two. They want to now extend the beautification from, I believe it is, Queen Anne Avenue or Dexter all the way down to the waterfront now.
Yeah, even though they don't have the money lined up for phase one yet.
Yeah, yeah. It's just amazing to me. And this is at a time when the mayor has asked city employees to give up 10 paid working days.
This is in a week when the city libraries are closed.
Exactly.
Yeah, starting this week.
You know, they're starting to really cut into basic services here, and they're still pouring money down a rat hole.
All right. Moving on, referendum 71 still up in the air?
Yeah, well, yes and no. It almost certainly will qualify for the ballot. At least the Secretary of State is almost certainly likely, probably on Tuesday, to go ahead and certify that referendum 71's backers turned in enough valid signatures for it to qualify on the ballot. Referendum 71, of course, the effort by conservative and religious activists to try and get the legislators act legalizing gay marriage in all but name onto the ban, I mean, giving them the civil rights that straight married couples have. They want to put that up to a popular vote, and it is very, very close in terms of whether they have enough signatures to do it, but it looks at this point like it almost certainly will do it. But a couple of other developments happened this week as well. One, the opposition to Referendum 71, Washington Families Standing Together, has already sued as of Friday to block R71 and is charging, and very accurately charging, that the Secretary of State has inexplicitly changed their counting standards several times during the course of their counting to figure out whether there are enough valid signatures or not, and that according to Washington Families Standing Together, that it has accepted signatures that it shouldn't have, particularly during the appeals process. Meanwhile, the PDC has decided that Referendum 71 backers have to release the name of donors. The backers had argued, and they've also argued this in federal court where their case is still pending, that because backers of Referendum 71 had been subject to threats by pro-gay activists, that that they should be able to keep the names of those donors anonymous. And in fact, there have been very explicit campaigns by some gay activists to out the backers of Referendum 71 in a similar way that backers of Proposition 8 were publicized in California last year. The PDC said that, quote, backers provided no evidence from or about donors that have demonstrated that they have received threats of violence against their lives or properties, or that they were being targeted for boycotts. Frankly, I find that hard to believe, because you find extremists and people who are a little out there on almost any side of a given political issue where there's a lot of emotion. And I can attest from personal experience that there are as many people willing to issue death threats on the left as there are, well, not as many, but there are certainly people willing to use violent rhetoric on the left as well as the right. But the PDC didn't feel that raised the issue of where R71 felt it should be, it should trump the right of the public to know who the backers of these initiatives are.
Right. I think the PDC basically said, basically said that you can't just say because these people are making names public that that is a threat, because public disclosure is public disclosure regardless of how it occurs. You have to show that there was real threat of violence, and that the attorneys for the referendum backers didn't do that.
No, they didn't.
All right, moving on to national news and a brief mention of Ted Kennedy's passing.
Yeah, I thought there were a couple of interesting aspects to it other than Kennedy's career itself, which has been, you know, covered extensively in the press. One was the very interesting chasm between the reaction of people who knew Kennedy in the Senate among Senate Republicans, with whom he forged a number of working relationships and in some cases friendships, and the Republican base, which quite frankly was out for blood even at the man's passing. And, you know, a hostile, a lot of hateful rhetoric that was out there. And what that says, not so much about the Republican base, because I think we've seen, particularly with the town halls this past month, how ugly a lot of that looks right now. And we saw it last year with Palin's rallies and so on and so forth. But what it says about the culture of the Senate, in that the collegiality there with, you know, 100 very privileged, mostly white, mostly male, movers and shakers, they hold each other in very high esteem, usually, regardless of any particular political ideology, because, of course, they all have a lot of things in common. Namely,
their income levels.
Yeah, more than half of them are millionaires. In fact, I think it's a much higher percentage than that.
Yeah, and those that aren't are very close.
Yeah, et cetera, et cetera. But the reason I mention this is because one of the things that has shaped those town hall debates and the healthcare debate, and I think actually much of the approach of President Obama to his entire presidency, is that his background is entirely as a legislator. It was in the Illinois state legislature, and then it was in the Senate, where his instinct is to seek reconciliation and to be very collegial with his colleagues. And this is something that Kennedy was known for. Unfortunately, that's not the political reality of how this country is operating right now, in its broadest strokes, that it is very partisan, it is very bitter, it is very divided. And I think Obama has seriously overestimated Republican willingness to cut deals with him and underestimated the hostility with which any of his proposals, regardless of their individual merits, just because they come from him, how those are going to be received. And his political strategies have reflected that, and that's why they have been particularly effective.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit, too, about how, you know, I was up in Vancouver when Senator Kennedy passed, and I found it kind of interesting how the Vancouver press covered it. They were all, you know, the Canadians were all very puzzled about how, you know, the U.S. talks a lot about democracy, but we seem to be completely absorbed with this idea of having an aristocracy in the form of these political dynasties like the Kennedys and the Clintons and the Bushes and the Gores and so on and so forth. And
this from a country that does have royalty.
Yes, yes. And I thought, you know, they are absolutely right.
All right. Well, one of the things that Ted Kennedy's passing displaced was news of Inspector General's report.
Yeah, the CIA Inspector General came out with their long-awaited report on Monday on the tortured under the Bush administration of non-high-level political prisoners of war, otherwise euphemistically known as detainees. These are people who are not, you know, leaders of al-Qaeda, but you know, people farther down the food chain. And remember that a lot of these people, no guilt of any particular crime has ever been proven, and a lot of them actually were found out later to actually not be guilty of anything other than being in the wrong place at the wrong time. But we heard of things like, you know, mock executions, using power drills, using guns, very gangster film-like behavior. And also, you know, if you're saying power drills, where does that sound vaguely familiar? I'll tell you exactly where it sounds familiar. It sounds familiar from the Shiite militias in the war in Iraq circa this same period of time, 2004, 2005, when the death squads gained great currency, particularly under the Interior Ministry. And a lot of that was linked to the so-called El Salvador option, people in the Bush administration who had participated in the Central American wars in the 1980s, who had resurfaced in Iraq, advising some of these Shiite militias, advising the Iraqi government, and suddenly there was the creation of these death squads that bore a great resemblance to what happened in Central America in the 1980s. 1980s. And one of the things that they used, one of their hallmarks, in fact, was torturing and killing people with power drills. This is also familiar because it was exactly what we criticized Saddam Hussein for doing when he tortured people under his regime, only he actually really had internal enemies who wanted to overthrow his government. So all in all, it was really a fortuitous bit of timing for the Republicans that Teddy Kennedy died when he did, because it really swept a lot of this truly nauseating stuff right off the front pages and into the media memory hole.
Yeah, although it was a big story in Canada, because it turns out one of the Bush interrogation techniques, which was immersion in cold water, relied on research that was done by Canadian scientists who were researching the effects of cold water on the human body in order to save lives of fishermen and sailors who fall into the ocean when they're doing research or they're on a fishing boat in northern waters. Canada is a leading nation in research for the effects of cold water on the human body. And the researchers, when they found out that their work had been cited in the torture memos and had been used by interrogators to figure out how much they could torture people before killing them with cold water, the Canadian researchers were positively nauseated to find out that their work, which they had assumed would be used to save lives, was being in fact used for torture.
Yeah.
So that was big news in Canada.
And again, this really underscores how, even though we don't particularly seem to think in this country, at least many people don't seem to think that torture is a big deal anymore, the incredible damage that it does to this country's reputation in other countries where people do still seem to think, for some odd, bizarre reason, that torture
is wrong
beneath civilized
yes, and,
behavior.
And some of these Canadian researchers came out and said, you know, we've participated in the experiments, actually been immersed in cold water ourselves. And one guy had said he'd been hypothermic 40 times in the course of his own research. He said that, yes, there is at certain temperatures, the human body can withstand cold water for hours and hours and you won't die. But it is so painful that essentially, you have to, the experiment can be stopped, has to be stopped because of the compassion of the people who are observing your innocence, your pain. So it was particularly disturbing to them to find out that the Bush administration used this work.
All right, moving on. And speaking of headlines, New York Times headline that the recession is over.
Well, no. That wasn't the headline. Oh. And this actually is up on the Times website as they speak. It was their lead story today until Kennedy's funeral bumped it. But it's still on the top screen of their website up at the New York Times that even though the recession is over and increased consumer spending in August because of cash for clunkers, although it's barely up and obviously it was an
well,
artificial
inflation.
Well,
it was barely up in July, and in August they just don't have the data yet.
Yeah. Excuse me, in July, you're right.
Uh-huh.
That even though the recession is over, people just aren't spending money the way they're supposed to, and this heralds that the glorious recovery that we're in the beginning days of may proceed more slowly than people already assume it does. And it is we talk about this, and Maria, you talk about it particularly on this show, this media bias toward just mindless cheerfulness on the behalf of economic quote-unquote journalism. But this is a particularly egregious example of it.
Yeah, and you know, the economic press here in the U.S. is having to explain what a recovery without a recovery is really like, because that's clearly what we have. We have a recovery that's not really a recovery. And so they're starting to call it a two-tier recovery, meaning that some businesses are doing well, but the rest of the economy is not, including, you know, the bulk of people who are classified as consumers. Yeah. What's actually going on, really, is that some businesses, particularly large businesses, are able to borrow money again like they could before the recession occurred. That's why they're saying there's some kind of a recovery. But I don't think it's a recovery. Personally, I think it is an impending crisis in the bond markets, another credit problem that is just waiting to happen. What's going on is some large businesses, instead of being able to borrow from banks, have been able to issue bonds to investors. So they're borrowing directly from investors who are buying their bonds. And fewer of these bonds that are being issued are being termed, are being classed as junk bonds, which I don't really understand, except if you think about it, the crisis in mortgage-backed securities was partly created by problems with the credit ratings agencies. And the fact that investors would be trusting credit rating agencies at this point, to me, just seems absolutely insane. The reason they're doing this is because bond investors or people who want to put their money someplace where it's going to earn anything can purchase treasuries and expect to get any kind of rate of return because interest rates are at zero right now. So instead, they're looking for something that will give them even a small rate of return. They're turning to the private bond market. So there's demand for those bonds. Big businesses that can issue bonds are doing it like mad. And in other words, they're borrowing to fund a recovery, which to me is just repeating the same problem over again.
Maybe they meant to two-tier recovery, as in those in power didn't shed more than two tears.
I think it's a two-tier collapse that's coming up.
All right. Only a couple minutes left to cover two international stories, starting with Colombia.
Yeah, we mentioned a couple weeks ago the Colombian base agreement that the U.S. was signing, in which the U.S. is using Colombian military bases, stationing U.S. military there, and claiming that it was used for the war on drugs. This, understandably, has concerned quite a few South American countries, particularly Venezuela, where Hugo Chavez has already survived one U.S. coup attempt. Now the all 12 leaders of the Union of South American Nations, including Colombia, have signed on to a statement warning foreign military forces not to threaten the sovereignty of any of the region's nations. Colombia is willing to sign on to it because the U.S. is mentioned but not mentioned by name, but Brazil, Chile, and Argentina, the three largest countries in South America, have all demanded binding guarantees be made that the U.S. military assets and personnel in Colombia, and that includes more troops and it includes Predator drones, not sure why you would need those in Colombia, not be used for any other purpose other than their stated mission of fighting drug traffickers.
All right. And Afghanistan.
The process of counting votes continues in Afghan's election. More than 2,000 complaints of fraud or abuse have already been filed with Afghan's Elections Complaints Commission. There will be a runoff if nobody has over 50% of the vote. And as of yesterday, the incumbent Karzai is leading 44-35. And we have more time next week. I want to talk a little bit about the nature of what that Karzai government would look like, what he's doing to annoy and distance himself from the United States, and thereby try to solidify his political power at home, where he has almost none.
And they've only counted about maybe 20% of the vote. They figure they're not going to have real returns on the Afghan election until about mid-September, I think.
Yeah, it's moving very, very slowly, and there's reasons for that.
Meanwhile, in the news, I saw the headlines, of course, that U.S. casualties are the highest so far in August.
The second highest month since the start of the war, the highest month since the start of the war, the second highest month was last month.
Yes.
So things are heating up there, at least for our U.S. troops.
Not coincidentally.
And justifiably so, some coverage of not so much heat coming from the left anymore since Obama has taken power about the war. But I think that's probably a discussion for another week. So talking as we do every week with Joe Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with local and national and international news and opinion and humor. You can find it where you find free publications of any kind. Well, not any kind, but most kinds. And you can also find it on the web, where you really can find publications of any kind, on the internet. But our website is www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, hot stories that you want us to cover don't involve, imaginary sky creatures. The email is editorial@eatthestate.org. editorial@eatthestate.org. Or info@eatthestate.org if you want to volunteer.